Oh yay. The court is now in session, and for once, we actually have a live, real case, a Supreme Court oral argument to talk about on conduct detrimental. We previewed the Alston Supreme Court, Alston versus NCAA case on the last conduct detrimental with Warren Zola and Greg Clifton. Today, we continue our collegiate theme with our special guest, MAC Conference Commissioner Rich Ensor. With me, as always, is my cohort in sports law crime, Dan Lust from the law firm of Garagos & Garagos. How you doing, Dan? It's been a long time, a couple of days. Welcome back.
So, Dan, this is our first two times a week episode. We banked an episode about Free Britney and all that stuff, but you know, we wanted to make sure we hit the heavy-hitting sports law issues. March 31st, 2021 will go down in the record books as one of the biggest sports law days in our recollection. Every 76 years, Dan, we have Halley's Comet. And every 37 years at this rate, we have the Supreme Court taking on college sports. So today or yesterday was like our Super Bowl, the heavyweight championship. This was why, you know, again, this is why this podcast exists. Topics like this that just permeate law, permeate sports. And I mean, I was on Twitter yesterday live tweeting. Everything was just blowing up. So many extra eyeballs paid to us. But Dan, you know, I'd be remiss. You used to have the intro of the podcast that said, oye, oye, oye. And now, like, you get to say it for real. Like, we had a Supreme Court case.
Yeah, I think we should just weave it into the intro going forward. It just fits so perfectly. I mean, when you came aboard and we kind of transitioned conduct detrimental from a solo to a duo, I think we changed the intro a little bit. But that was fun. I like the opening segment. But you know, this time it's for real. You know, to quote Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, there actually was a Supreme Court oral argument, and I'll beg to differ about the impact that this is going to have in sports law. I would rank Murphy versus NCAA as potentially more meaningful. Well, I guess that you could beg to differ on that. That's actually an interesting debate. But yeah, we're 3 years away from you know the floodgates opening for state authorized sports gambling. So you know, sports law has taken a couple of quick major stops in recent years at the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're absolutely fascinating. And one of the nice things about the Alston case is that this one was available live on C-SPAN. Usually with the Supreme Court oral arguments, if you're not there in person, you've got to wait for the transcript, you know, a couple of hours later, and then maybe there's an audio recording up on the Supreme Court website. But at the end of the day, this was the first sports law case that was orally argued in real time where we could all listen to it. And that obviously gave rise to your live tweeting, which you excelled at. And I miss doing that. It's been a couple of years since I got to live tweet a court case or in my example, a multitude of different court filings in the Deflategate case. That is so much fun. And you definitely rocked it yesterday. So I just thought, well, why not just continue on our college sports theme with our guest today?
I guess two things, you know, just to your point. I don't know, Dan, if this is going, and we talked about this, you know, just I maybe demystified it with Greg and Warren. At issue is not like paying college athletes. It's like giving them reimbursements on laptops and being allowed to pick whatever externships they want. It's not like the sexiest topic, but at the end of the day, like, what did this do? It allowed the judges and allowed the public to kind of have, I don't know what else to call it. Like, I watched Game of Thrones. It was almost like the Cersei scene when like they're bringing the shame bell. If am I speaking English right now? Do you know what Game of Thrones is?
Oh, so, yeah, of course. I'm very, very well aware of Game of Thrones. Still mad at Joffrey for his beheading.
But I bring it up, Dan. Cersei's walking the street with the shame bell. This was our opportunity in the Supreme Court, and the bench laid into the NCAA's lawyer. You know, you guys are making billions and you can't pay your athletes $6,000 on a stipend. You know, so it was an all-out attack. And just so everyone knows, you know, if you're a betting man, you could read, you know, any friends of the podcast, be it Mark Edelman or anywhere down the line, everyone's predicting the NCAA is going to lose. But our other friend of the podcast, Gabe Feldman, said, listen, just because everyone was attacking a particular viewpoint, it doesn't necessarily mean that that side's going to lose. Sometimes quite the opposite happens.
Dan, I would want to, you know, weigh in on here. I would tend to agree with Gabe. You know, Gabe clerked for U.S. Court of Appeals judge. He practiced at Williams Connolly for a number of years, and he might be you know, for my money, you know, one of the top most, I've never heard anything not insightful come out of Gabe Feldman's mouth. And that's absolutely true. I don't think this is a binary result, affirm or reversal. I think it is so nuanced. And I think the decision that ultimately gets rendered by the court has some, transformational aspects to collegiate sports, but also could have aspects to the ruling that pair back on the ruling, made in the Ninth Circuit. So I think it's going to be sort of a mixed bag. And, you know, I think the judges signaled. The great thing about oral argument is they're not playing poker. They're not asking questions just to be sort of playing a devil's advocate role. It provides you with a window into what the justice is thinking. And certainly a number of the justices expressed some, you know, raised more than raised eyebrows at the NCAA's hypocrisy of capping, you know, benefits to student athletes, while at the same time, you know, building new stadiums, the coaching salaries, and the economic model surrounding collegiate football. And you know, Justice Kavanaugh in particular, Justice Alito. And Justice Alito was the Supreme Court justice who wrote the majority opinion in Murphy versus NCAA. So while we tend to, you know, like to put the justices in these sort of labels of being conservative, and if you're conservative, you're pro-business, quite the opposite happened yesterday with some of the questions and comments made by justices who would strike you as among the most conservative on the bench, whereas some of the more liberal justices like Justice Breyer, you know, seem to kind of hint at maybe opening up a Pandora's box if the relief that Jeffrey Kessler is seeking on behalf of the Alston class is granted. So I'm not so sure this is going to shape up as either a 9-0 affirmance or a complete reversal. I think it's much more nuanced than that. And Gabe is absolutely right.
It's obviously a big day. We'll break it down. You know, for purposes of today, Dan mentioned we have a big guest today. It's Rich Ensor. So we've kind of hinted, you know, for these last couple months that 2021 will be a year where college sports changes forever. And we're seeing that play out in the legislature, in the judicial branch. College sports is being attacked from all angles, for better or worse. It's being attacked and there's change being instituted. So Rich Ensor is, a follower of the podcast. He's been resharing our stuff over on LinkedIn. And I reached out and I said, it's a great time to have someone like you on. MAC commissioner. It's a Division I basketball program. They have Siena, they have Iona, they had Rick Pitino. So he's Dan mentioned it. He's a 30-year commissioner of the sport. He's the longest tenured commissioner in all of college sports. So he's seen a few things. He started in August of 1988. Dan, I was born the month prior. So my existence on earth has only been 1 month longer than his tenure as the commissioner of the conference. That's how astute he is. That's crazy.
You know what else happened in August 1988? I began my first year of law school at Hofstra University School of Law. Tom Coughlin began his first year as the wide receiver coach for the New York Giants under legendary head coach Bill Parcells. And obviously Coughlin coached a receivers group that included Stacey Robinson and Stephen Baker, the touchdown maker, Mark Ingram Sr., and helped coach that squad up to a Super Bowl in January 1991 against Buffalo. But it just goes to show you how his tenure, Rich Ensor's tenure has transcended so many and spanned such a long time horizon, several generations seemingly. So he'll have a lot of insights on the world of collegiate sports because he's been there from the infancy, from almost the infancy of the MAC conference.
Women's basketball, esports, COVID, sports betting, we covered the entire gambit with Rich. And that said, let's take you directly to the interview with MAC Commissioner Rich Ensor.
Our next guest is the longest serving collegiate conference commissioner in the country. And he started his tenure at a time when the legal dynamic around collegiate sports was a lot simpler. 1988, Rich Ensor has now stepped into this vortex of legal issues surrounding the world of collegiate sports, COVID-19, name, image, and likeness, amateurism, sports gambling, and with the NCAA tournament, underway, it seems like the perfect time to speak to one of the most plugged in collegiate sports commissioners in the country, treasurer of the Sports Lawyers Association. Welcome to Conduct Criminal, Rich Ensor.
Thanks. Good to be here, guys. I think you get to be longest serving commissioner by default. It's not so much you aim for it. It just seems to catch up with you.
It's impressive. You began your tenure when Bill Parcells was still coaching the Giants. Before Tom Coughlin became the wide receivers coach of the Giants, you
Before
were the
Tom Brady. Who'd have thunk? It's been a long run. I got involved with this job because they were really searching for a commissioner. The league was in trouble. It's one of the early examples of college conference restructuring. So they lost Fordham, Army, Holy Cross, and another school. They lost some to the then Patriot League, which was being formed. And so they were in a situation where they were going to become under the minimum number of schools you have to have for continuous membership to have an NCAA bid to the basketball championship. So they brought me in, it was myself and another, it was an AD from one of the member schools, and I ended up getting it. And ever since, it's just been one long ride. We found members, we righted the ship, and I've been very involved with restructuring and all that for years and years because of that early introduction to the new world of college sports.
So a couple things. I mean, for the people that don't know, the MAC conference has 11 member institutions. It's Canisius College, Fairfield, Iona, Manhattan College, Marist, Monmouth, Niagara, Quinnipiac, Rider, St. Peter's, and Siena. I went to a small school, Union College, which was very close, very close to Siena. So when the Siena made their Sweet 16 run, I was in college back then. Ryan Rossiter, I had a friend that was on the team. Eric Harris was a backup center. Ended up going to law school with him. But, you know, we connected on LinkedIn, and then I kind of went through your posts, and you seemed to be very outspoken at a number of, we'll say, hot-button NCAA issues. And maybe first and foremost, the one that we wanted to get into, you know, you have involvement, and I'd love for you to speak to about your background, but you have involvement on the NCAA women's basketball side, and you do have a role with the NCAA where you're advising on day-to-day activities in that part. So the controversy that, we dealt with, maybe in the last 2 weeks at this point, the Oregon's women's basketball team were posting about the disparities between the weight room. And I saw from any number of levels, there was disparity in the food, the gift bags, the bubble, COVID-19 tests. But there was very clearly a disparity between what was going on the men's and women's side. And then there was obviously an investigation that Mark Emmert announced that there would be a New York law firm looking into the disparities across men's and women's sports. So, you know, Rich, I wanted to get your overall thoughts on kind of where that stood and your overall thoughts really on the situation.
Well, I've been involved with basketball, women's basketball, for about 15 years. I served on the sport committee for 5 years. I then was put on the Women's Basketball Oversight Committee, which is the governing subcommittee that deals with all issues related to recruiting and scheduling and all that type of administrative, and ended up serving as chair for that for 2 years. And I was reappointed to a new 5-year term a year ago. So yes, I have a long background. And yes, we have been talking since I got on the committee 15 years ago or so about these issues. These are not new issues. What really came to the forefront was because of the pandemic, and this may be one of the best outcomes of the pandemic, they had an opportunity to put these two championships in, you know, big domes, Alamo Dome for the women in San Antonio, and the men are in the Indianapolis Lucas Oil Stadium. So, and all of a sudden, you know, they're pushing out on the men's side all this social media. Look at our great weight room. Look at all this swag. Look at all these great meals. And the women are sitting in San Antonio and saying, where is ours? You know, they got a little exercise room, no major swag, just some leftover items from, you know, corporate sponsors. And from that TikTok moment has come all this, this investigation. And so it's the little things that really sometimes spark the big investigation. And I think this is an example of that. Mark Emmert and his staff should not be surprised. Many of the issues that we're currently suddenly discussing nationally, we've been discussing on these committees for years. I'll give you a few examples. We've talked about why the men have 68 team bracket, but the women have 64. You know, that's four less women's teams that have that chance to go into the tournament, and those athletes and those coaches looking to build careers. Why does the NCAA own the NIT and fund all travel and participation and even have some revenue sharing from that event? The women have to pay their way into the WNIT, pay their travel, and oftentimes schools won't send them because of the finances. You know, why do we have to deal with issues like the basketball academy, where they were going to have 300 boys coming to training camp this summer in Indianapolis, and they weren't doing the same thing for the women? They subsequently yesterday announced they're going to put that on hold again for another year because of the pandemic. But there's just these systematic elements of how they've treated the men and the women so differently based on the revenue flow from the men's event. And that's not how college athletics should work. In the MAC conference, we run our tournament side by side. Our men and women are in Atlantic City this year. The only differences you would see in that operation from the men and the women is the women play in the afternoon, the men play in the evening. Some of that's driven by when we can sell tickets, which hasn't been the case for 2 years. But when we can, you know, there's better, you have to go with the better times for the men just for that reason. Actually, for many reasons, I think the afternoon's better for the women. It gives them more recovery time and other things like that. But, you know, that's the only obvious difference you would see how we run things. But if you look at the men's and women's Final Fours, they're very different. The branding on the men's site is so extensive. They have all the March Madness. It's all pushed out. They have CBS Turner running their back office social media efforts and webpage, which is very sophisticated, includes streaming, includes opportunities to sell sponsorships on it. They have they hire third-party vendors like Populous, which is a big worldwide firm that does events. They hire 14 people from them to help them put on the event in Indianapolis. And the staff of the men's is like 14 people. The women's is 6 full-time staff. You go down to San Antonio, they have none of that. In fact, I'm sitting there watching the games with my wife, who's not a big sports fan, but she's going, why are the men so nicely branded? All the floors look great. And you look at the women, they're playing on a floor that had a high school three-point line on it. You know, these are just obvious things that should never happen. And Mark Emmert has said, mea culpa, mea culpa. Everybody's saying the right thing. But now we got to make sure they actually do the right thing.
Yeah, Rich, it's about more than doing the right thing. It's doing the legal thing. You know, I've been a lawyer for, you know, maybe not a long enough time, but I know about Title IX. That was enacted in 1972. From what I would gather, the effective date of that law, it was decades ago. How are we still, or why are we still having this conversation today in a post-Title IX world, or in a Title IX world, with the kind of compliance issues that these obvious disparities raise?
Well, you see, one thing, Title IX technically doesn't apply to the NCAA because they're a private institution. They're not public, nor do they take federal funds, which is how the government gets into the Title IX space. When you receive federal funds, you have to comply with Title IX. Now, they don't talk about that much. And by and large, they try to do things equitably. It's just in this showcase event of theirs, they're not. And they're getting caught up in a public way on these disparities. And it was just, it's a little bit hubris. It's a little bit tone deaf. But, you know, when you talk, we have within our own bylaws at the NCAA, there is a bylaw that talks about equitable treatment for all athletes. You know, on some base level, everybody's being treated the same here. But when it comes to the sponsorship, the promotion, the exposure, the broadcast network, and how it's being implemented, ESPN's been a great partner, and they put a lot of our games now are all on national feeds instead of regionalized feeds. And we had, I think, 7 games on ABC, which is a real first for us. So ESPN and ABC have been great partners, but there's just so much more to be done. And the real problem here is they're leaving a lot of revenue on the table because they can't get it out of their mindset that you can sell women's sports. 9 of the top influencers right now in college sports are women's basketball players. There's only one that's a men's basketball player. That's because they stick around for 4 years, they graduate, they're great role models. You know, the public gets to know them and recognizes the type of quality people they are. And they're also kind of, you know, they do things that college kids do on social media, and they draw as fans. So they're leaving a lot of revenue on the table. They keep telling us for over a decade, they started using this term return on investment. It started when Mark came on, but also with some of his staff. And it was all about co-ed cutting and return on investment in women's basketball. But you have to invest in order to get a return. And they just have not been able to get through this mindset that you can't sell women's basketball. And it's really short-sighted given the success you're seeing in across the board. And even in our women's basketball, we've had sellouts at the Final Four the last few years. You know, audience viewership is way up. So they're just being short-sighted and it's starting to come back and bite them where you don't want to be bitten.
To Dan's question, and I think it's a common misconception among sports fans, and I get it a lot in my DMs, and, you know, how can the NCAA avoid Title IX liability? You know, but you still see, like, lawsuits. Like, I know there was a lawsuit last year by seven women against the NCAA. You know, they said breach of contract for fraud. So I guess the breach of contract is this lack of equitable treatment, and they're saying that it's a breach of those bylaws. But I think to Dan's point, like, and I think, you know, public sentiment is like, hey, Mark Emmert, you could pay for a very fancy law firm to run a really fancy investigation and tell you exactly what you're doing wrong. Or it's just the obvious at a certain point, right? Invest equally or don't have the optics be so poor. Do you think that, you know, college sports still face another wave of lawsuits, maybe people that are trying to sue for this lack of equitable treatment? It just seems like it's out there.
Well, I don't know about on that particular topic. I mean, the NCAA is always going to be an easy target, frankly. You know, the National Association, most people don't really understand how it works. It's a huge task to try to govern that group. You know, you got 1,000 schools, even in D1, you got 360 schools. We all have a say, we all have different opinions. So when you try to manage that, that's a difficult thing. So I don't want to understate what they have to deal with day to day. And I do really think they try to do things equitably, guys. They just, on this particular issue, they've fallen flat. And somewhat by design, they just got in their heads that they could do things cheaper on the women's side, save some dollars, and just focus on the men. And it's unfortunate because Lynn Holzman, who is the vice president for women's basketball, and she's not even a part of the senior leadership team at the NCAA. She reports to Danny Gavitt. But, you know, she's a Kansas State player. You know, she's committed to the sport. She was a commissioner that came out of the West Coast Conference and took that job because she has a passion for women's basketball. They would just let her get in there and make her case, and also then provide the kind of resources they are with Turner CBS and the sponsorship sales effort. What happens with sponsor sales, and I don't want to get too granular here, but what happens with sponsor sales is CBS Turner, because they pay this huge rights fee, has those rights to sell and recoup their investment. But in the process of doing that, you end up blocking out the women's sponsorship sales because the categories are closed or they're exclusive. And so you have a whole lot more of obstacles in the way to any great sales. And then the activation is all around the men's event because both events are on the same weekend, which is, by the way, one of my pet peeves. I don't know why we can't go a week later with the women's Final Four. You know, they'll tell you it's against the Masters. It's in ESPN, CBS are very committed to the Masters. Well, fine, find another network. But, you know, they don't approach it that way. So, you know, you have exclusivity on sponsors. The sponsors don't activate around the women's tournament because all their monies and efforts are being placed on the men's event that's taking place concurrently. And it just becomes so very difficult to break through. And not because the product's bad. The product is getting great. These games on the Sweet 16 on the women's side have been as good as anything on the men's side, in some cases better. That UConn game against, I think it was Iowa, it was just a grand game. You know, it really was exciting from start to finish. So they're just missing out on a great opportunity here, and now they're getting publicly humiliated because they didn't do the right thing to begin with. Am I outspoken enough yet?
No, you're fantastic. This would probably be legal malpractice if we didn't ask you about this, knowing what occurred yesterday at the Supreme Court level. Also versus NCAA, and then on the other side of it, Dan and I have spent a couple podcasts talking about what's going on in the legislative angle, and there seems to be this kind of confluence that we're getting to a point where paying college athletes or allowing them to receive some type of compensation is coming front and center. So, you know, I imagine in your role, you were keeping a very close eye on the arguments yesterday at the Supreme Court. NCAA versus Alston, and any number of justices laying into the NCAA's position and also laying into Alston's position. I'm going to give you the floor. I mean, what are your overall thoughts after hearing oral argument? Where do you think it goes?
Well, I'll separate to it. You got NLI, you know, kind of in there too, but we'll talk about that a bit.
Do that separately. I gave you a lot.
Yeah, but the on the pay for play element, we've been headed in that direction for a decade now. We've been giving more and more benefits to the athletes that are on full rides. You know, we provide any number of different sources of funding. They can work now if they choose to, which, by the way, we fought over that for years. And, you know, here's a shock. Most of the athletes prefer not to work if they don't have to in the summer. They want to do other things. But in any case, yeah, I think we're going to end up with probably even looser standards as far as pay for play. But if you read some of those transcripts yesterday, the justices also realized there's a real danger here that you're going to blow up the college amateur model. Now, maybe some people, including Jeff Kessler, who's on the plaintiff's side here, and I know him through other litigation, you know, they just as soon see that. They want free agency. They want them to be basically pros. And I think there's a real danger, because while there are sports where athletes will be able to benefit from that, by and large, the bulk of our athletes won't. And the way we manage to fund all that is going to get potentially destroyed. So there's a lot of danger there. And I was sitting around thinking this morning as I read the case files, you know, how are they going to limit that just to college? You know, once they open that door, high school, you know, any amateur should be able to get paid for play. So, and I think, I don't know which justice, it might have been Keegan, I don't know who it was, but they mentioned, we don't want to get into the business of running college sports. And that's a wise decision, but I think we're headed down the path of some type of pay for play. And I worry about what that'll do to the model overall. In the MAC, you know, we're a good, solid mid-major conference. I wouldn't see us paying any players, frankly. You know, it isn't that important to the school's mission, frankly. These A5 programs that are, you know, multi-million to $100 million operations, you know, they're going to have to weigh that. But even the Big Ten has said they're not going to pay athletes. They go to D3 before they do that. But, you know, we'll see if they actually do that if and when it happens.
So that's kind of where we were getting to. And I'd be remiss, we didn't mention the big hiring that Iona had this past year with, you know, Rick Pitino coming over. I'm from Westchester County. So Rick Pitino.
Okay, sure.
Iona. I kind of circle the wagons with Mac. I'm in Schenectady. I'm Westchester. Yeah, yeah. I understand the NCAA's position, but then it's almost like at a certain point, if and when the floodgates open, right, the first school that pays, right, I'm going to put it in quotes, maybe they get a recruiting edge. So where we're setting up, and this is kind of the NIL question, which I don't think there's an easy answer to, but Florida is supposed to enact their name, image, and likeness bill on July 1st, 2021. Right. Now, is it a MAC issue? Not necessarily, because you guys are a Northeast Conference, but it's somewhat of a MAC issue, and it's somewhat of an every conference that not in Florida issue, because athletes, if they're picking between, hey, should I go to the Northeast or should I go to Florida and get paid in theory? I don't see a way around it. There seems to be a looming war between the NCAA, Florida schools, and then the rest of the states in the country. How do you kind of see the NIL battlefield shaking out on that level?
Well, I think we're up to maybe 16 states that are putting laws into effect. So it's growing. All the states are going to do it. You know, it's an easy political, you know, to put that in. You know, what politician isn't going to push that through the system at some point? But what we need is one set of regs for the country. So the NCAA has been trying to get Congress to give them the authority to be able to put through the antitrust laws some exemption so they can organize this NIL process, or if nothing else, put in a countrywide regulation that everybody has to, you know, follow and supersede all the state laws. I'm not worried about the NIL. I don't think it's as big a deal as some people make it. In our level, there might be some athletes that could do it. You know, it's somewhat dependent on how we structure it. My own feeling is that all the athletes should be just viewed as independent contractors. And so if they can do a deal with a shoe company, or if they can do a deal with the local pizza place, you know, it doesn't matter to me. As long as they're doing it themselves and they're taking care of all the taxes and everything else, and it doesn't become a burden on the member schools. And I think that's fine. The big danger in it all is boosterism. But, you know, we already have regs on the books for boosterism. you can't give a kid $100,000 now and not get a foul of the NCAA regs. You couldn't give him $100,000 for name, image, and likeness if there wasn't some kind of direct tie to why he's receiving that fund, other than you're a booster at school A and he goes to school A. So I think we make too much of it. I think it probably offers some great opportunities for the athletes in certain sports. And like I mentioned, 9 of the 10 top influences right now are women basketball players amongst the two sports. So I'm okay with it. And I think we'll have to regulate it. And I'd like to see a nationwide law, so I just make it simpler. And I don't want to have it become a compliance function for schools, because that would put a huge burden on already strained resources to do compliance regulations. I think they should be independent contractors, and you know, they want that freedom to do that, then go ahead, but make sure you file the right tax papers and make sure you don't get, you know, taken to the cleaners by some unscrupulous agent. But you know, that's part of being a, you know, an independent contractor. You got to run with it.
Okay, Rich, I'd like to jump in with an issue that's near and dear to my heart. You just recently completed a conference, you know, tournament in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and 10 out of 11 of your member schools are located in states where sports betting is legal, and the 11th school, Fairfield, is about to join that group. I think you're about to become the only athletic conference in the country that is completely covered with legalized sports betting. So the question I have is, where do you see sports gambling and legalized sports gambling fitting into the vision of the MAC conference in terms of, you know, maybe contemplating sponsorships, almost akin to what the, you know, Colorado University did with PointsBet? Are you at the point in time where that's something that's on the table for your conference?
Little context. 30 years ago, we signed the New York State Lottery as our first major sponsor. So we've been involved in gambling, I think, however you want to categorize the lottery, for a long time in the MAC. And I think a lot of the good priests that form many of my colleges, they invented bingo. I think at St. Peter's University, where I went to school, they built the gym first, not for basketball, but so they have a bingo hall to raise funds for the school. So I think sports gambling is a highly regulated state function. I've live 40 minutes from Atlantic City. I've been around my whole life. I've seen it come and go, the ups and downs in that town. I think sports gambling is a natural outgrowth of it. And would we take sports gambling sponsorship? I think so. There's all kinds of guardrails around what you can do or not do in Atlantic City on events that are taking place in Atlantic City. But that's just the world we live in now. And Quinnipiac, by the way, is in Connecticut too, Dan, just so you know. So we have two Connecticut schools. But I think, you know, we've had casinos in most of our cities for a while now. So we're comfortable with it. And we all are, many of my schools now have gaming majors, you know, as part of the business school. They're teaching, how to manage gaming. And I don't see it any different than any other industry. You have to pay attention. And as you probably know, the bookies are your best friend, because they'll know when something's wrong. You know, the BC gambling scandal of a couple of decades ago, you know, that came to light mostly because of the bookies said, what's going on here? The spread, you know, it's not right. Something's wrong. So that's how, you know, they reported it to the FBI. So, you know, I'm not particularly upset about it.
Well, I think it was a stroke of genius to choose Atlantic City as your conference site. I know you were debating between Albany, the Nassau Coliseum, which was in my, you know, hometown. I grew up in East Meadow, and Atlantic City. And I think it's just a natural fit given the, cross section between, you know, sports, entertainment, and gambling, and the New Jersey Division of Gambling Enforcement or Gaming Enforcement. The DGE is probably the most respected gaming regulator in the entire country. So if you're going to be in an environment where you're going to have the regulatory, you know, backing and, you know, sort of the robust regulations to protect the sport, to protect the conference, I think you're in the right place. Now, year one, you know, during COVID was, you know, obviously not what you expected in terms of an audience or an attendance in Atlantic City. But I believe over time, with sports betting becoming such a big part of the landscape, I think you've chosen the perfect environment to raise visibility around your conference tournament.
Well, part of our strategy there really was to be able to attract young alumni and to come to Atlantic City because of all the entertainment and gaming options they would have. It's already happening, but the whole March Madness and the prelude with the conference tournaments is 6 weeks of nonstop college basketball taking place. And it's becoming a huge opportunity for these sports gaming companies to cash in on. And, that's just business. We don't, frankly, I used to go to the Garden when I was in college. You know, everybody knew what the point spread was. People are cheering if, it was a 20-point game and somebody hit a basket at the end to make it 18, all of a sudden everybody's cheering because, it covered the spread. So, that's been going on as long as I've been in sports. It's just been in the background. Now at least it's regulated. And frankly, the AC model for us only works because the Casino Redevelopment Authority underwrites a significant amount of funding for us each year to be there. And we're there at a time of the year when the hotel rooms are fairly empty. And so we're bringing business to the community when they need it. So It's a great opportunity for us. Unfortunately, the pandemic has really hurt us the first 2 years. We'd like to extend it a couple of more years, even just as a give back to the sponsors. We've also foregoed our rights fee for this year and last year because we didn't have fans in attendance. So it's hurt us economically, but that's the way it goes. It's a pandemic. What can you do? You just have to work around it, but I think it has great upside.
On a related note, just to kind of new things entering college, the college sports level, one of the interesting things in your background, which I find very fascinating, maybe this, insurgence or the injection of esports into the college equation. So, I at one point prided myself as a very big video game player. I am nowhere near a professional level, but I know that you're teaching a course on it. And can you speak a little bit about how esports is become part of vernacular college sports and where it goes from here?
Sure. About a decade ago, my son, Kiernan, he was going out to the Garden. And I said, "Oh, who's playing?" He said, "Oh, it's an esports tournament." And I said, "Esports tournament?" Yeah, I knew what esports was, but because I used to play a game called Descent when I was first married, and then that became an issue when we had four children. But that's another story. Yeah. So he's going out, and I'm giving him a hard time. "You're going to go watch, esports on a TV, big video screen in the Garden?" He said, "Hey, Dad, it's sold out." Well, that got my attention. Kiernan is very involved. He's president of an esports league right now, but he worked with me at the MAC and when he was at school at Canisius in Siena to organize the esports. And we're in Albany right now, but we ran a an esports tournament here 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, where we were able to see that this really engaged people. And so we're the first league that made it a full-fledged sport within our league. It's treated just like basketball. We have bylaws on in-season, postseason. They get awards just like basketball. And partly it's because we want to capture a younger demographic that has gotten away from traditional sports and bring them back into viewing sports on TV and as they become alumni. And we also use it as an admissions tool. And frankly, we're all private colleges in the MAC. We're always in the business of finding students. And a lot of the students in esports are STEM students. So it's fascinating. But Kiernan yesterday had an issue. They had some incident. And this is a problem a little bit in esports with, one of the teams, I think Penn State or Virginia Tech were playing in his league. And they had some nasty things to say about the women on the one team. And it got public. And so he had to step in yesterday and suspend the team and do it in a public way and said, "Welcome to being a commissioner, son." But he did it well. And, we do have to worry about those issues. And I commended his boss, Anthony Gould, on how they handled that. It's difficult to manage, but you have to do it or else it'll get out of control. But otherwise, we find, esports to be a great addition. And we're in We offered it. We had four championships this year. So the teams just finished three of them. And I think the Riot championship is about to get going. We're with a company called EGF in New York City, who runs our championship. And Mainline does our back end stuff on the web. You need all these support systems. And the kids love it. So we just handed out trophies for three championships. We got another one coming up.
Yeah, Rich, before we turn to your fascinating career, you know, I'm a New York basketball junkie, and the schools that comprise your conference have a long, rich tradition in collegiate basketball. I'm thinking of Niagara University, Calvin Murphy's school. Murphy played ball there. I remember following, you know, Jim Valvano and Jeff Rulin when, you know, they were the kings at Iona. Will we ever see the day? And I think we can, because basketball's different, you know, very much, very different than football in terms of the facility requirements, the expenses, and the overhead. Do you think we can see the day where a team like an Iona or one of your you know, NCAA tournament teams that make it can go on a deep run? Because I think we could see a Gonzaga or a story similar to that one day coming out of the MAC conference. What do you think it will take for a school like that to just, you know, is it just luck? Is it just getting hot at the right time? Because you have the tradition, you have some great coaches in the conference, and you've come close. You've made, you know, some schools have made the round of 32, maybe even the Sweet 16. Can one go all the way?
Well, you know, we have examples right now, Illinois, Chicago. You know, that's a Loyola, Illinois. That's a, you know, a Catholic school like some of mine. And, you know, Gonzaga's Jesuit school, also like Loyola. So, but the thing about the MAC, the short answer is you could. But the thing about the MAC is our school enrollments are relatively small. You know, we run anywhere from a couple of thousand to six at the top end, and there's only a couple of those. Everybody compares us to the West Coast Conference, but those are big private institutions, BYU and Gonzaga and others. They're big schools, 10,000 enrollment and so forth. Why I mention that is because resources for sports in our league come out of the regular budget. And the regular budget is generated by tuition dollars. And tuition dollars are a function of your enrollment. So when you have a two-thirds less enrollees than some of these other private schools, you run into these issues. That being said, I don't think it's impossible. You just have to have the right chemistry come along with a coach and the players. Rick Pitino, as you know, came back to Iona, and he had a great year. He's been a pleasure to work with, very professional, and has helped us on a couple of projects. So it's nice to have him in the league, and I think the younger coaches will learn from him. I hope they learn not to swear as much as he does on the side. But outside of that, I'd like them to learn a few things.
I'm still, it's you know, been a long time, but I'm still outraged that he was the one to leave the Knicks back in at the end of the 88-89 season. Yeah. It led to sort of a decline of the franchise until Riley came along. He was so perfect. And he ran into a personality conflict with Al Bianchi at the time. And Pitino just, you know, left to go to Kentucky. And I never got over that because I thought he was the perfect coach for that team. And I know he didn't have as much success coaching the Celtics. But he's a sort of a tried and true New Yorker, really, really belongs in the New York area. And I'm so happy that he's continuing the success at Iona that Tim Klus, you know, has started and continued for many years. What a legendary coach he was.
Oh, yeah. And it's tragic he had to leave us. And I still don't even know what illness he had, but it's too bad. I know Joe Mihalik, who's a former coach in the MAC at Niagara, he just retired at Hofstra for similar reasons, I guess. So it's very bad when you have that. But the New York Metro is a great basketball area, and we benefit from it. But it's also a huge pro market, so you have to break through that clutter. There's a great appreciation by the fans of the level of basketball that's played. And anybody will tell you the MAC basketball day in and day out is tough, top to bottom. There are no easy games in our league. I will tell you the biggest issue we have right now is the transfer portal. I don't know how much you track that, but that's where athletes now can declare and to go transfer at will, basically. There's over 1,000 men's athletes right now, basketball players in the portal. There are almost 850 women's, which is mind-boggling to me. there are not enough places for all those athletes to land. And they're also confusing the landscape as it relates to bringing in good high school talent. Because how do you, where do you fit all these players in? Are you better taking a third year transfer with a true, with a tried record of success, or at least certain skills that you can see demonstrated against other D1 programs? Or do you take a high schooler who may or may not pan out at the end? So the portal is a huge issue. It's a kind of an outgrowth of the whole freedom of movement athletes. It's kind of not an NIL issue, or it's not the pay for play, but it's all part of that whole, you know, structure we're dealing with right now. And I think it's going to hurt the game badly. Fans aren't going to get to know the players. The players are going to move around like pieces on a chessboard. A lot of players are not going to land anywhere and going to get hurt because of this. And then we'll start reading those stories, you know, in the next year or two. And it's very hard for our schools because they don't, they literally do not know who they're going to be coaching the following year. So I know how frustrating it is for our coaches. It also has potential, like a Rick Pitino, who is a very, is very good at obviously evaluating talent. I think, and he brought in a lot of new talent this year. I think he could really benefit, but for a lot of young coaches that may not have worked at that level before, I think they're going to have a hard time.
So Dan and I, you know, during the COVID-19 pandemic, we were following all different NCAA adjustments and how they were moving forward. There was one that I maybe now we're seeing the ramifications of it, but when they extended eligibility of basically every sport and they were still allowing high school seniors to come into college, that obviously created some type of a logjam because you probably had someone that was promised starting time, you know, playing time, and then that senior didn't graduate and they played. Is that what we're seeing, that this transfer portal, is that maybe part of it?
Yeah, I think, well, transfer portal is part of that, and it might be why so many more athletes are going into it. I think athletes are doing it just because they can, frankly. You know, some of them are just saying, yeah, let's see what, who else wants me now that I've been here a year or two. So I don't, the portal is a whole nother issue. The eligibility issue is going to be a problem. I was on a call this week with the Women's Basketball Oversight Committee. We had two issues relative to that we were dealing with. The SEC is proposing that they, anybody that's meeting a certain standard and stays at their school for, I don't know, fifth or sixth year, I don't know what we're up to at this point, but that they wouldn't count against squad limits, basically. Hmm. Well, you know, my concern there is that now you're going to start warehousing talent because you're going to bring freshmen in promising they'll play, and you're going to keep players that you know are, you know, a true commodity on. And then you're going to, you know, so, and now we're not going to have any limits on that. We could have had 18 or 20 players. So that, you know, that issue, you know, we're opposed to that. Just we think the talent should be spread around, not warehoused at certain programs. And then the other one that came up was we were looking at international students. And I think there were about 245 of these individuals last year that couldn't get back into the country, partly because of Trump's immigration laws and partly because of COVID wouldn't let them travel. And we wouldn't let them in if they, you know, if they hadn't had the right tests or vaccinations or whatnot. So there's this bulk of athletes out there that were harmed last year, and we waived them for another year of eligibility so they could get back in the system this year. And they came to us again and said, well, should we waive another class because this is still going on? And, you know, I think our position basically was we've got to get back to normal. Starting July 1, all the rules apply as they always have. We'll have to work our way through the glut of talent that may be in the system for a couple of years, but at some point we have to right the ship. And we're also disadvantaging our domestic students. If international students are playing a couple of years of club ball and now they're 20 years old or 21 years and they've had all this added experience and now we're bringing them in to play against 18-year-olds. So I don't think we're going to go that route, but that's just a couple of symptoms of the kind of things we're dealing with right now.
Maybe it's professional jealousy, but your background is like the perfect background for someone that is interested in sports and law. I mean, it's just, it's all over the place. So, you know, as we're wrapping up, you know, your resume on LinkedIn, and I'm sure there's probably stuff that LinkedIn is missing, that years of experience, but I'm just going to run through it really quick. And we have on our listenership, we have a lot of young lawyers. We have a lot of law students, some, you know, college kids, high school, that hear sports law and they just want to be in that field. They don't really know how to do it. So you started, you graduated from St. Peter's University, one of your Mac schools, with a poli sci degree. And I'm sure the last thing that you thought was that I'm going to be the commissioner of the Mac conference. But, you went on to work in sports information at St. Peter's, a sports information director for 3 years. Then you got your master's in sports studies at UMass Amherst. And then Seton Hall Law School came calling on you, got graduated from there in 1987. So, if I'm tracking, you've basically been the commissioner of the Mac conference since you graduated law school.
2 years. Yeah. 2 years afterwards. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess it's a broad picture, but, can you tell us just, about that path, and then any advice that you'd have for people that are trying to make that transition maybe into a, it's a separate column, but you're obviously using your JD for all this type of stuff.
Oh yeah. The JD comes in, and particularly on contracts. I work with contracts all the time, but a lot of the issues we've been talking about today are all legal, obviously. So I deal with it on many fronts. JD degree really opens up a lot of doors for you, gives you options. I passed the bar the first time. I never practiced, but I think I practice every day, but it's one of those things. I was a traditional entry point type of individual. I had been the manager of our basketball team for 4 years. My coach, Dick McDonald, took a job at St. Louis. He said, "Rich, come with me. You can be an assistant AD." I didn't really know what an assistant AD did, but I went out and learned and was out there for a couple of years. He took another job and I came back east and did that SID work for 3 years, which gives you great writing skills and an understanding of what goes into the day-to-day operation of a sports team. And then, that got to a point in time when I realized I needed a master's if I was going to move up the food chain, and went to UMass, where I met a guy named Glenn Wong, who's a great friend of mine and colleague.
Arizona State, Glenn Wong, right?
Yeah, Arizona State. But he was at UMass there, and he was writing the sport and law book with Bob Burry at BC Law School at the time. So I ended up working on that as a graduate assistant for a couple of years. That reignited an interest I'd had for many years ago to law school. And so I ended up at Seton Hall. I was working part-time for Larry Keating, who was the AD there. I ended up becoming the marketing director for a year after I got married. And then when I graduated Seton Hall, Glenn said, "Why don't you come up and teach for 2 years?" Not for 2 years, just come up and teach at UMass. So I took that opportunity, was newly married. It was a nice transition. I was a little older, so it was good to have that time with my spouse. And we started a family. And then St. Peter's called me, the president, who I'd known for years, Ed Glenn. He passed away a few years ago, but a great guy. He had been John Thompson's buddy at Georgetown, and Bill Stein, who had been John Thompson's assistant, was the AD at St. Peter's now because of Father Glenn. And Father said, "Rich, I want you to go after this job. You could really help this with your TV marketing, your just organizational skills." So we put in for it, got the job, really didn't know what the job was. Again, learned as I went along. We had to deal with that membership issue. We added 4 new members. I had to get budget things straightened out, learned a lot quickly. And, it's kind of a pathway of traditional moves in the industry, marketing director, SID, assistant AD, and then also picking up the degrees and networking that led to this position. And then, the first 5 or 6 years at the Mac, I really just worked on getting the Mac right. We came up here with the Knickerbocker Arena when it opened in, with a hole in the ground when we signed the contract. It's now the Times Union Center. We took advantage of being in a smaller market, but with a bigger team, without a lot of pro influence in the area. So that allowed us to grow it. And that's become a pretty good success story, the tournament itself. And then I got involved with the NCAA stuff, because Richie Regan was one of my mentors at St. Peter's, a great friend of mine and colleague and a famous basketball coach and player himself. He said, "Rich, always take care of the business at home before you do the other stuff." And that's kind of how I approached it. And then the committee stuff just came along. I take sometimes the undesirable committees, I don't care really. If I want to be involved, I'll be involved. I'm not looking for, men's basketball committee. I'm more than happy to be on the women's because I like basketball. And I had been a manager of the women's team when I was at St. Peter's too. So, it's just natural development and inclination. And And I think I've had some skills that I've been able to help people with. And I always try to help up and coming lawyers and students. You know, I pride myself on our employees. We bring in a lot of people. They stay a few years and they move up the food chain. This year in Atlantic City with the pandemic, we had to do a lot of things we don't normally do. We used the convention center separate from the Orwell Call to set up practice sites. I brought back a former employee to do that. We had to do COVID testing, a $200,000 operation, by the way, and for 7 days. I brought back two former employees to run that for the week. Ruben Perez came up from Atlanta. He just wanted to volunteer and help. He had worked for me. And Ken Taylor, who's at Mammoth, came back and helped me with when we opened up the doors for friends and family. He managed all that for us. You know, Leslie Claybrook, who was at the SEC and was a colleague of mine on the Women's Basketball Committee, she came up and helped us work things. So I used all those networks. Even my son Kiernan did the post-game Zoom interviews. But we brought all those people back, and it was great to see all the success they've had. And I was pretty proudful of the fact that I was able to do that, both for the success of this year's tournament, but also that we had that network of alumni that were willing to help.
Well, Rich, you've just all but assured that you'll be receiving a spate of resumes from sports law aspirants. Because even for all of your great accomplishments in your career, there were people who've helped you along the way. You mentioned some of the real pillars of sports law. You know, Bob Berry, I think he created the first sports law, you know, course in the country at BC. And Glenn Wong, who all of us know through the Sports Lawyers Association. So it does kind of underscore the importance of, you know, friendships, relationships, and, you know, extending a helping hand to people, you know, on the way up and people who are looking for a leg up in the industry. So you've been really generous throughout your career. It definitely shows. And I want to thank you for spending so much time with us on Conduct Detrimental and covering a wealth of or mix of all these, like, diverse legal issues, probably none of which were even within your contemplation, you know, 30 years ago when you took the job and Bill Parcells was coaching the New York Giants. So the industry has evolved, and thanks for sharing your experiences and insights with us, you know, today.
Well, it's great fun. I always enjoy doing these things. It's another way to network, really, not just with YouTube, but with the people that watch your podcast. So we're always happy to do these events and podcasts, and appreciate the offer to do it today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rich. We appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day, guys.
Great. Bye-bye, Rich. Talk to you soon, hopefully down the road at SLA conference.
Yeah. As soon as we get it back on in a building, we're going to do another virtual one this year, but it's just what it is, you know?
So that was Rich Ensor, MAC commissioner, sports lawyer extraordinaire. What a background, Dan. What a conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his resume, you know, probably could take up a half a mile of page space. But for those of you in the sports law communities, not only the MAC conference commissioner, but he's an officer and director of the Sports Lawyers Association. So he's really deeply embedded in the sports law community and has had some really, you know, major mentors, people that we know, like, you know, Glenn Wong, and he's crisscrossed with so many of us in sports law. Fascinating guest, covered so many interesting issues, and really, I mean, he has sort of the gravitas to you know, really lend, you know, such rich insight onto all of these issues. And it was a pleasure to have him on in our first college, you know, commissioner of all time on Conduct Detrimental. So he hit it out of the park, and it was just an enjoyable conversation.
As always, you can find Dan Wallach on social media at Wallach Legal, myself at Sports of Lust at Instagram and Twitter, and the show Conduct Detrimental at Twitter and Instagram. And actually, Dan, update for everyone. We moved our TikTok account over. Watch this one, Dan. At Sports Law is the new TikTok account, not at Conduct
Detrimental. That was available? That was available at Sports Law.
Truly might have reserved it, and I gifted it to our podcast account because those guys have been crushing it. Dan, that said, let's put this one in the books. And as always, stay tuned for more at the intersection of sports and law. And we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.